about voter fraud and not the truth about voter suppression. Since 2010, we've had 22 states that have passed voter suppression laws where you've had the highest turnout of black and brown people. And on election day, there were 868 fewer polling places in states with histories of discrimination. And there were 158 less voting sites in the black communities in North Carolina. When people will cheat like that, standing down is not enough.
That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Tune in to KBOO every Friday at 6 p.m. from September 15th to October 15th for KBOO's Hispanic Heritage Month series. Join KBOO in celebrating and paying tribute to the contributions and enriching influences of Hispanic and Latinx Americans and their ancestors. You'll hear from volunteer producers from Buscando America, Boogie Pachanguero, Noticias en Español, and more. Again, that's KBOO's Hispanic Heritage Month series, every Friday at 6 p.m. from September 15th to October 15th, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Democracy is an experiment, and so is community radio. During this fall membership drive, KBOO will take a deep dive into democracy in all its forms, from current events to music programs. KBOO is your community connection. We're non-commercial and independent. We're supported by our members. So show your support by becoming a member of KBOO today. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. You can also mail a donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon.
Times Like Now is an interview program. Interviews with interesting people who are doing cool stuff. My name is Trevor Collins. Thank you for tuning into the program. On today's episode, I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Howard Librand, the Skagit County, Washington health officer. This is part one of a two-part episode. We'll be speaking about COVID, about vaccines, about variants, and about some alternative medical treatments that are making the news. This is Times Like Now. Dr. Librand, thank you so much for joining me on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
So a quick introduction to Dr. Howard Librand, a little bit of your background or your specialty, your pedigree, if you will.
Okay, well, I'm sort of becoming the old guy on the block because I've been in public health here in Skagit County for 31 years. I've been an emergency room physician for most of those years. Most recently here in the last couple of years, I went back and got a board certification in addiction medicine, and that's sort of my day job. Half-time that with half-time health officer in Skagit County and now Island counties. So 31 years of experience in public health, and I'll have to say that this is by far the most significant situation we've been in public health in those 31 years.
Very much. I can imagine that. So a bit more of background. In the earliest days of COVID, one of our first cases that came through Washington State, and in this area in particular, made some international and national news, and you were involved in this in the church choir.
Right, the infamous choir. It's a community choir that was that did its practices in a church building, so it really wasn't a church choir. That's a subtle nuance, I guess. And of the 63 people that attended this one setting, 56 of them, I believe, became ill either and tested positive for COVID or just became ill in that setting and were assumed to have COVID. But that was back in the days when testing wasn't very available. And then, unfortunately, two of those individuals went on to die of the disease in the first few weeks of the major portion of the pandemic.
And that became a big to-do because of the kind of the controlled environment of that, all these people in the same building at the same time. So that was why you were kind of the doctor of the moment, being interviewed by some big publications.
Right, and we at the health department, led by Leah Hamner, our epidemiologist, wrote an article for the CDC MMWR weekly report. And this was important because it sort of established the super spreader nature of this COVID virus, that you could have that many people become ill from one exposure. It also started us thinking about whether this was actually airborne and not just droplet. I think there's some subtle nuances there where it's a continuum, but it at least got us thinking about how infectious this was. And it set the tone for our county because we could refer to this horrendous event and use it to explain why we wanted to do what we wanted to do. And then on a national level, once this CDC MMWR reports was published, it quickly became, at the time, the most cited CDC report during the pandemic. And mostly that was because the fact that this was singing in a church and people were thinking early on about getting back to their places of worship and whether they could be singing, how dangerous that was. And I think that this clearly showed early on how dangerous this illness could be.
And you, correct me if I'm wrong, but were you not working closely or kind of reaching out with Governor Inslee in the state of Washington?
Well, we, the health departments of each of the local jurisdictions, each county health department, we pretty much meet every Friday with Department of Health. And Department of Health is, during this entire pandemic, has been closely associated with Governor Inslee and have been the one of the big driving forces behind his desire to do what's medically right and what's supported by science and what has the best hope of containing this illness. I was on a few calls with him directly, but I don't know that I worked actually with him, but on a regular basis. But it's certainly in Washington State, the policy of the governor is driven by public health.
Right. Now, so jumping forward, those were the first days of COVID. How far we have come now, and things have been getting more and more erratic and chaotic out, I guess, on the streets and in the public and arena. Things are getting weird, and I know you're not a psychologist, but what is the root of this fear of vaccine, in your opinions? Again, not as a psychologist, but this is the ground that we're on now, and people seem to be very resistant to get this vaccine, even medical professionals, which I find
Well, we can
stunning.
Come back to that particular issue, but the the basic distrust in government. It's kind of interesting to me that the Republican president who was in office at the time that the vaccine was developed really wanted, and rightfully so, to take credit for at least being supportive of that effort. But it's so turned around now that, frankly, the political divide has spread over into the area of medicine so dramatically that the majority of unvaccinated people are Republicans. And I find that very intriguing. It's kind of like there's a self-perpetuating echo chamber where the distrust of the government, the distrust of science, the distrust of medicine, all sort of gets focused on this one thing. And, there's always been people who are concerned about vaccines. And there's a lot of politics and even outright scams that have gone on to support that distrust. But it's spread so completely now with this particular issue. And I think it's because we've politicized medicine, which shouldn't be politicized. And there is no political benefit to the vaccine, to the treatments that we use. Yet they are divided politically. So it's perplexing to me. It's always been perplexing to me that people would not support something that is so clearly effective and also so clearly safe, safer than the diseases it's intended to prevent. So,
well, certainly, I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but it's over how many million? 60 million in the United States have been vaccinated.
So there's been 300 million doses given.
300 million. That's what I read. I was thinking it was 320 million, but I know it was somewhere in that range.
And that's some people get two vaccines, obviously. So that doesn't mean that there's that many fully vaccinated people.
It almost seems that the fear of the vaccine is or has become a virus of its own, an internet meme of sorts, or as we said earlier, a echo chamber of sorts that's perpetuating this virus amongst, as you said, a lot of more conservative-leaning people. Now, all the while that this is going on, hospitals are filling up with unvaccinated people, and morgues are bringing trucks to the hospitals. It's tragic.
Yes, it certainly is. And, not to say that the vaccine is perfect, because no vaccine is perfect. When we first delivered the vaccine to the American people, December, January, almost a year ago now, the predominant strain was the natural strain of COVID, and it was probably 95% effective against that. And that in itself sounds like a big number. A good number, and that's true, it is. But when you talk about giving it to 300 million people, the number of people whom the vaccine doesn't protect is pretty substantial. You can do the math. But so you're not completely protected from getting this vaccine, but you're so much better off than if you didn't have the vaccine. And then in the people who do get it, it's far less dangerous. The people who do get COVID after having the vaccine, we call them breakthrough cases, they do much better. There's a much lower incidence of hospitalization, serious illness, and death. Now, the 95% number was against the original strain. The vaccine is, I was going to say, not as effective against the Delta variant, but it is. That's a little bit short-selling the vaccine, because the vaccine is far more contagious. So whether you're vaccinated, let's back up. The virus is far more contagious.
The Delta variant is far more contagious.
And whether you're vaccinated or not, you are more likely to get the Delta variant than you would have been to get the original COVID natural strain. So,
right.
But right now in hospitalizations nationwide, over 90% of the people who are hospitalized are unvaccinated. And
of the four people that I personally know who have had COVID, three were vaccinated. They were all at home. Of course, they were not well. It was a bad flu. But of the four that I know, three have been vaccinated. The one who was unvaccinated was in the hospital for over a week, fortunately recovered. This was an older person. But yeah, that's three out of four. But obviously Delta, I believe.
We have to be careful with statistics too, because three of the four people that you know who got this disease were vaccinated. That's because you probably tend to hang out with vaccinated people. Whereas in the general population, it would be more like 10 to 1, 8 to 1, instead of 3 to 4 like is in your experience.
Right, right, understand. So as we were discussing earlier, some issues have come up with side effects of this vaccine. Senator Johnson of Wisconsin bringing patients to Capitol Hill to tell their stories. And there was a few people, I did notice they were all women, coincidentally or not, had gone through partial paralysis. Now, you had a name for this.
We're probably talking about Guillain-Barré syndrome. It's actually a fairly common situation that arises from many different viral infections. And several of the vaccines, historically, we've seen an increase in the amount of Guillain-Barré syndrome. And people think that it's probably just part of the body's immune system overreacting to the virus that's infecting it or to the vaccine that has been given to it. And then that causes a temporary but very bothersome paralysis and numbness. They almost universally, the people with Guillain-Barré syndrome recover. It sometimes takes anywhere from 2 to 6 months, and very, very rarely some are left with continued paralysis. Just to put it in perspective.
But how prevalent is that? How often does this kind of thing happen, do you think?
It has occurred mostly in the current day with, in regard to COVID vaccines. It's occurred with the J&J vaccine, Johnson & Johnson.
The Johnson & Johnson.
There's been about 13 for every million people who get the vaccine report having this Guillain-Barré syndrome. Now, in my experience...
13 yes. per million.
In my experience as an emergency room physician, we would see multiple Guillain-Barré cases throughout the year. Not a huge number, but enough so that it was easily recognizable and that you it was sort of one of the things you thought about. And those were caused by, apparently, viruses. Some of them may have been caused by vaccine. I don't know. And there's no way to pinpoint. But there is a background level of Guillain-Barré in the community all the time. And you'll hear that refrain with the other things we're going to talk about here too. But in the cases that we are aware of, there's been, at least at the time that 14.5 million J&J vaccines were given, there were 13 per million at that point. So that's hundreds of people who got this temporary, very bothersome problem that resolved.
So just to jump ahead just a little bit and just to, I guess, educate some that may not know, can you fairly quickly, concisely explain how mRNA vaccine works in the human body against the COVID virus. Just so we're all on the same page, and anyone listening that doesn't know how mRNA might be working.
Yeah, so all vaccines work very basically work in the same way. What they do is they show the body a variation of the pathogen, of the germ, that they're trying to teach the body to fight. And once the body has seen this, either a dead virus, a dead bacteria, or one that's been inactivated so that it's no longer contagious, or a portion of the protein that makes that's unique to that that germ. Once the body's seen that, then it's able then to mount a quicker immune response and get on top of that infection before it becomes a problem. It's kind of like showing the Revolutionary Army the redcoat's uniform so they would know how to recognize them.
Okay. That is a great explanation, a great visual.
So that's changed over the years. The original vaccines that we use, for example, cowpox was used to teach the body what smallpox looked like without infecting you, because cowpox and smallpox share a lot of the same traits, but the cowpox doesn't cause disease in humans, or doesn't cause serious deadly disease in humans. So the body learned by being exposed to cowpox, it learned how to fight smallpox. There's other inactivated viruses and bacteria. There's throughout the years have been used like this. So fast forward to where we are right now, the RNA is a messenger that tells the body what proteins to make. So the DNA in your cell, in your cell nucleus, codes an mRNA messenger fragment that then leaves the nucleus of the cell, goes out to the protein synthesis portion of the cell, and tells the cell what proteins to make. Then that RNA messenger called an mRNA is then destroyed. And that happens within hours of when the message was made. And that's continuously going on in your cell. So what they've done with the, let's even explain this a little bit more too. The way a virus works is a virus cannot live alone without a host cell, because it doesn't have the ability to synthesize proteins. So what a virus does is it's just a little capsule of RNA or DNA, and it fuses with the human cell wall and puts that message into the cell, which then tells the cell protein synthesis manufacturing equipment what to do. And it churns out all these proteins, which then join up and make viruses and burst the cell. And then all these viruses go out and do the same thing. So what we've done in that's dangerous. I mean, you get sick from that sort of thing. So what we've done is we've taken a little portion of the genome of the virus, and we've used that to, knowing what that gene sequence is, we make an mRNA, synthesize it, really. It doesn't come from COVID virus. We make it. And we put that message, it's a recipe for a protein, we put that into a little lipid capsule. The capsule is injected into the muscle, and that little capsule joins with the muscle cell and injects that mRNA into the cell, not into the nucleus of the cell, but just into the cell, and it's picked up by the protein synthesis mechanism, and a protein is made, which is specific and only found in the spike of the COVID virus. And once that protein is made, then the body recognizes it as a foreigner and starts a response against it, and that is the basis of the immune response that happens. Now, that's mRNA vaccines.
So, I'm sorry, I was going to continue this idea. The mutation of viruses certainly makes our science and our medicine have to mutate the vaccine, and that's why we have a different flu shot or a variant of a flu shot year, correct?
I said that's correct. Now,
okay, I had a little audio glitch there. So I heard, overheard that the flu shots that we receive today in 2021 still contain a bit of the information, I guess, from the 1918 Spanish flu, because that is still mutating in the... Is that true?
Well, I think that's a considerable overstatement. So the flu shot doesn't have the entire gene sequence of the virus, of the flu virus in it. It only has very specific pieces of that, of the viral genome, or the viral protein sequence, really.
Okay.
And it just so happened that the 1918 flu was very similar to the 2009 swine flu, which was similar to another swine flu that was seen earlier. So if you were able to know what was coming down the pike and kind of recycle the information from those, it is very similar. The 2009 was very similar to the 1918. So it, okay. But you don't really have a memory of the 1918 in your flu shot. They're all just very similar with small variations that make them
right. I mean, that was what I was getting to, is the mutation of it, the evolution of it.
Right. So the thing that's comforting about COVID, if anything can be, our ability to make the, let me put that another way, the spike protein on the COVID virus is what matches with the human cells to actually infect the cell. The spike protein is also what the vaccine is made to match, so that causes our body to make antibodies which match with that spike protein. So if the virus mutates its spike protein so that it's not recognized by our antibodies, which were made by either previous infection or by getting a vaccination, if it mutates it enough so that they're no longer recognized, it also isn't recognized by the receptor on the human cell, so it's no longer contagious to the humans. So there's kind of a little protection, I think, that's serendipitously built in there, where a variant that's too much of a variant for the our immunity to recognize is also too much of a variant to be contagious for us. That's not totally true, but so, that's a general rule, I think, that's protecting us, because a variant which could evade our antibodies is a variant that isn't infectious, so it doesn't propagate, it doesn't do its thing in the cell, so it can't infect the next host.
So the latest variations that we're dealing with, of course, is Delta. We also hear the word Lambda, and the new one that I've been hearing is it pronounced Mu or is it M-U?
There's also, yes, Mu, Mu, I think, Mu. And there's also Epsilon. We don't know a lot about them yet. We do know that there is a small amount of all of those circulating in the United States, but it's certainly not becoming the predominant strain at this point. And there will be more. As long as we have the hugely high rates that we have right now, there's just a big petri dish of mutations going on with all these huge numbers of infections that we have. So the likelihood of there being a new variant that's more contagious or more dangerous in some way, I think as long as we keep our rates this high, it's pretty likely that we're going to come up with another variant that's a problem.
The frightening statistic, speaking of statistics, that I heard today, 52% of Americans say that they won't be vaxxed under any circumstances. That sounds very troubling, given everything that you've just explained.
You're saying that 52% won't get a vaccine?
That's what I heard today upon
That's interesting
NPR.
Because more than that already have.
I would say of the remaining people who are
right.
Who are
so
not.
Herd immunity is an interesting thing because it depends upon the infectivity of the virus. Back when we were developing our vaccination strategies, the infectivity of the virus as measured by the R-naught number was maybe 2.3, I think, was the number that was most common.
That is, one will give it
yes,
to 2.3.
And that's people who don't, who aren't doing anything to protect themselves. And we got that number down to around one. That's why the natural virus is gone, essentially. And when it's at one, less than one, then the infections gradually die out. And if your virus, if your R-naught value is 2.3, it takes approximately 70% herd immunity to counter that.
Dr. Liburn, I'm going to stop you right there, put this into a two-part program to cut this now, and then we'll come back with part two. Thank you for listening to this episode of Times Like Now. Past episodes can be found wherever you get your podcasts. Part two of my interview with Dr. Howard Liburn will be next week. Thank you to the letter J, Cody Robertson, for original music. I'm Trevor